I knew that Fox had a weak image in terms of race. I encountered it on the job and in the public with comments from people like, you'll never excel there because you're not the right color. Or you're not blonde enough. Or they'll only allow you to go but so far. Some people have even asked me, how can a black man work at Fox News?
Fox News anchor Kelly Wright at a press conference today. He has joined nearly a dozen other Fox current and former employees in a racial discrimination lawsuit. We'll have that story coming up. But first, apparently UC has been hiding money, a lot of money. A blistering state audit says the office of the president at UC has kept secret more than $175 million. And the report said salaries are a lot higher in that office than they are in comparable offices. The audit comes just months after the UC system won approval for its first tuition hike in 6 years. And the findings have angered some state lawmakers. Joining us now, Assemblyman Jose Medina. He chairs the Assembly's Higher Education Committee, and he represents Riverside. Hello.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, what was your reaction when you read the audit?
Well, I was very much taken back. Wasn't expecting to see that, so I was somewhat surprised, shocked, and frankly, disappointed.
And so now you say you'll conduct an oversight hearing to look more into the findings?
Tuesday, we have three committees coming together, higher education, JLAC, which asked for the audit, and the sub-2 committee in the budget that oversees education and higher education, all of us coming together for a hearing with President Napolitano.
And what do you hope to learn from that hearing?
Well, I want to get some kind of an explanation as to how this could have occurred, and to hear from the president herself, and see how we can move forward, you know, how we can best move forward. To my estimation, the transparency is certainly is key here in the legislature, key to me, key to the taxpayers, and we're not seeing that with hiding of $175 million.
So she has said in a statement, and we did reach out to her office, and she wasn't made available to us by the time we went on air, but she has said in a statement that the audit unfairly characterizes her office's budgeting process, and she says her office did not hide any money.
Well, it's $175 million that I would say the legislature certainly didn't know about, and that calls into question, I think, as you said maybe at the beginning of the show, the tuition hike that was just approved by the Board of Regents the first time in 6 years. We are very much involved in the process of allocating money. And it has not been clear to us that this money was there. And I'm not sure that it was clear to the regents that the money was there.
Do you think that you would not allocate as much, or you would not have allocated as much in the last budget had you known about that $175 million?
Well, I think, and I agree with our Lieutenant Governor, Gavin Newsom, that the regents should go back and revisit the raising of tuition. $175 million is a significant amount of money. Looking at the audit, this is an amount of money that is accumulated over 4 years.
So, but the tuition hike is 2.5%, right? And I'm assuming that that would be a lot more than $175 million.
I know that for the CSU system, I think $75 million would cover the amount of tuition that the CSU system is suggesting. So $175 million is a significant amount of money.
Mm-hmm. So this tuition increase, this is up to the Board of Regents. The legislature
can't
do anything.
They were the ones who raised the tuition at the Board of Regents meeting.
Right.
But I'm suggesting that it's something that they should revisit.
Now, they say they've had to raise tuition because state budgets, well, you guys haven't allocated enough money for the UC system, and that they need the extra funding. So is some of the blame on your shoulders for tuition increases, that if the state allocated more funding to UC, the system wouldn't have to raise tuition?
I don't argue with that. I have been here for the last 5 years championing the cause of higher education as the chair of higher education, and specifically to UC. But it makes my job very difficult when something like this comes out in an audit. It makes my job as a champion of University of California very difficult here in the legislature and with my colleagues.
What about the salary part of it?
The salary seems, I'm looking at the report, the salaries don't seem to be in keeping with other state salaries. I know that the much higher salaries are being paid by people doing similar jobs with a considerably higher salaries. I'm looking here, it says 10 executives paid $3.7 million. 700,000 more combined salary with the highest paid state employee counterparts. So both the salaries and the number of employees looks excessive.
Yeah, the CFO, the chief financial officer for the UC system, makes $412,000 according to the audit, compared to his counterpart at Cal State, who is making $341,000. Does that seem excessive to you, $412,000?
Well, it seems out of sync with what other state employees are making for doing similar jobs.
What is the explanation on the part of UC that the salaries are higher?
You know, I have always, and I have always heard UC, you know, saying that we need to pay, you know, top dollar, for people like the presidents, and I don't argue with that. I know it's a competitive market, and we want UC to be the best. We want the best in our presidents. We want the best faculty. So I understand that UC needs to be competitive. But they seem a little bit, well, maybe not a little bit, quite out of paying much higher salaries in comparable positions to other state employees.
And again, that's not something that you would have any control over in the legislature.
No, but it's certainly something we can address and call into question.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Madeline.
That's Jose Medina. He chairs the Assembly's Higher Education Committee, and he represents Riverside. President Trump was back on Twitter this morning in a series of tweets blasting a federal judge's decision which blocked his plan to punish sanctuary cities. The judge issued a preliminary injunction, but his decision looks like he's willing to issue a permanent injunction later. Joining us now to discuss the decision is Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School. Hi there.
Oh, hi there. It's What's Happening in Our Legal System Wednesday with us.
It certainly is. Okay, well, enlighten us. Let us begin at the beginning, because this ruling centers on Trump's executive order. What did the order say?
Well, the order, I mean, let's use one word that Judge Bill Orrick used, which is schizophrenic. So the order essentially says to the Trump administration, you put out this executive order. It was incredibly broad. It was very vague. You essentially tried to coerce localities into either cooperating with federal immigration authorities or you would lose federal funding. And then you come into my courtroom, and I'm getting too much into the role now, you know, and then you come into court and you say, oh, no, we're just using the bully pulpit. And actually, this is a pretty narrow executive order. And what we're really saying is there's these three grants that go through the Department of Justice and Homeland Security. And these are, you know, just three small grants, and they're already conditioned on complying with immigration authorities. And that's all we're talking about. We're just talking about implementing existing law. And the judge essentially said, you know, let me continue my role play here. So the judge essentially said, well, that just can't be the case. But that actually is the only legal basis for the executive order. But that's just small and toothless. And he said, and that's where your position is schizophrenic. And San Francisco and Santa Clara, who had challenged the executive order, had some, I think, very strong constitutional challenges. And again, the order is essentially saying, you know, localities, you have this choice. If you want your federal funding, you're going to help out federal immigration authority. And for a variety of reasons, Judge Orrick spent about 49 pages saying, let me tell you why I think that's a big problem.
And number one being, in his opinion, it violates the 10th Amendment.
Right. And again, as you said in the beginning, this is just based on a temporary injunction. So this isn't a decision on the merits, but it's a decision as to whether, in part, when you look at a temporary injunction, one of the questions is, are you likely to succeed on the merits? And Judge Orrick said, yes, I think you are, in part because the 10th Amendment says the federal government can't reach in to states and cities and localities and say, if you want money, you better do this for me. That's called impermissible coercion. And this is a legal principle that is applied to strike down laws that are or executive orders passed by both Republicans and Democrats. So Judge Orrick cited, as and it's a very smart move to do this, he cited to a Supreme Court opinion where the Supreme Court said, Obama administration, you told states that if they want their Medicaid funding, that they better comply with the Affordable Care Act. And that's basically putting a gun to the head of a number of these states, because for some of them, that's a huge part of their budget. And they said, you don't get to do that. That violates the 10th Amendment. There are also some other issues going on here with respect to the Fifth Amendment, which we know kind of more familiarly as dealing with due process, which essentially kind of boils down to Judge Orrick saying, we have problems here in terms of vagueness. We have problems in terms of overbreath. This is a very broadly written executive order. And we also have problems with notice. It doesn't really say to local jurisdictions, if you feel like you're wronged, here's the process by which you can challenge that and be heard. And so, again, it's not a final ruling on the merits, but I think we know where Judge Orrick is going with this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, and so let's talk about the vagueness, because from what I understand, the Trump administration was arguing, look, there's no harm here because we haven't actually done anything. And so you can't really get relief if we haven't done anything and you haven't suffered anything, right? So why wasn't he buying that?
Well, that's it. And I think the last thing you said, you haven't suffered anything, is exactly what the Trump administration was trying to say, which is, well, if nobody's hurt, then nobody has, quote unquote, standing, because mm-hmm. we know in federal court that you need to be injured and that whatever you're suing for, if you're granted that relief, then you'll be made whole again. Your injury will be, you know, we'll put a Band-Aid on that paper cut, basically. And so the judge said, I'm just not buying that, in part because the judge looked at statements, and this is interesting. I think it's something that we're going to see more throughout this administration. The judge said, let me look at statements by President Trump himself. Let me look at statements by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Let me look at statements by Press Secretary Sean Spicer. A lot of people have said, when you see a federal judge saying, let's go to the record and look to what Sean Spicer said in a press conference, it's not going to be good for the Trump administration.
Okay. And, well, yeah. And he said, look, you have to take this into consideration, what you're saying in public statements.
Yeah, exactly. And he said that, you know, I understand that you came into my court and you said that this is very narrow and we're just going to use our authority on existing policies, you know, again, those small federal grants. But he said that's just simply not what you've been saying. You've been saying basically we're going to bring states and localities to their knees. We're going to say you don't get federal funding unless you help with immigration. That is a view that is consistent with the wording of the executive order and is consistent with everything you've said up until the point when you walked into my courtroom and realized that you had to really narrow the reading of the executive order.
We have a quote from Donald Trump when he was on Bill O'Reilly's show on Fox back in February, and I believe the judge actually cited this quote. Let's hear it.
As you know, I'm very much opposed to sanctuary cities. They breed crime. There's a lot of problems. If we have to, we'll defund. We give tremendous amounts of money to California.
So you're
California,
going to defund.
California in many ways is out of control, as you know. Obviously, the voters agree. Otherwise, they wouldn't have voted for me.
So defunding is your weapon of choice.
Well, it's a weapon. I don't want to defund a
but
state
you're willing
or a
to do
city.
It.
I don't want to defund anybody. I want to give them the money they need to properly operate as a city or a state. If they're going to have sanctuary cities, we may have to do that. Certainly, that would be a weapon.
A weapon. And the judge actually cited that.
Yeah, isn't it terrible that when you go on national news and you say, here's what I want to do with respect to a certain policy, then it comes back to haunt you. And I think, you know, again, we're going to see judges, if the Trump administration continues to do this, where there's, and we've seen this with respect to the so-called travel ban, there's a broad travel ban And then the Trump administration goes into court and kind of tries to pare back on exactly what that means. And we see judges saying, well, I know what that means because you've been telling me in the press for months now over and over again. And what it boils down to is essentially Judge Oreck said to the Trump administration, you know, I simply don't believe you. And what you're trying to do here just smacks of executive overreach. You don't have the authority. That's also the exact same theme that we saw with respect to the travel ban.
Okay, very quickly, and, in a few seconds, where does this go next?
Where does this go next? Well, the Trump administration has said the Ninth Circuit is going bananas. That's incorrect because this is a district court judge in the Ninth Circuit. But leaving that aside, the Trump administration could appeal to the Ninth Circuit. They've said we're going all the way to Supreme Court. They could appeal to Supreme Court. They could do something similar to what they did with respect to the travel ban, which is create a more narrow and more nuanced executive order. They could direct Congress to try and work with them on a spending bill, or they could simply let this play out in the district court. There will still be a trial on the merits in the district court on this issue.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we want to hear from you. What do you think? Should LA be a sanctuary city? Should California be a sanctuary state? What do you make of this decision? Tell us your thoughts on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Fox News is in trouble again. There is a new lawsuit. This one is charging racial discrimination. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Less than a week after host Bill O'Reilly was fired for sexual harassment, there is more trouble now at Fox News.
We have a culture of systemic and institutional racial bias. And so when my colleagues from other departments began to publicly reveal their encounters with blatant acts of discrimination in their department, I watched it, I prayed about it, I cried over it and said, I can no longer sit in silence, collect my paycheck, and act like I didn't experience racial bias on my own level as an on-air personality.
That's Fox News anchor Kelly Wright. He's joining 10 current and former employees who are suing Fox News. There are two other separate racial discrimination cases, too. Eric Wemple is media critic for The Washington Post, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on.
Delighted to have you. Well, this suit argues that Fox's controller, a woman named Judith Slater, said and did racist things to people in the payroll department, and basically senior executives did nothing about that. What exactly is she accused of doing?
She's accused of doing really a series, if you read the document, the complaint, she's accused of doing just about everything that could possibly be racist or insensitive, making fun of people's hair, making fun of people's, pronunciation of words, saying that black people can't, these are the words that black people can't pronounce, mother, father, ask, saying that Hispanic or Latino women, like a woman from Panama, that white people wouldn't eat the sort of food they eat. It's just all this stuff, making comments about the hair of minority folks, and also getting into one of these people was a cancer survivor, and she called her the one-boobed girl. She was a breast cancer survivor. This document and the previous document that's part of this racial discrimination suit against former controller Judith Slater is one of the most sort of jaw-dropping documents I've ever read in this position.
I heard that there was one thing that she asked minority employees to arm wrestle white supervisors.
Yes. Yes, that is in the allegation, and I think out of fairness we should point out that a spokesperson for Ms. Slater has denied these allegations. Yet they keep sort of snowballing, and this is a pattern that we saw last summer and, you know, into the latter parts of last year and into 2017, which is that Gretchen Carlson last July filed a sexual harassment suit directly against former Fox News chief Roger Ailes, and many women followed. The same exact pattern is being observed here, which is that earlier this year, a month or 5 weeks ago, a pair of financial side employees at Fox News filed this suit against Judith Slater and Fox News over racial discrimination. Now we have 11 more people coming aboard, and it's seeking certification, I believe, as a class action suit. And today the attorney for them, Douglas Wigdor, says he expects more. Mm-hmm. So this is, yes, this is the new sort of center of Fox News's difficulties.
Now, Kelly Wright has a slightly different claim, and he has a claim against Bill O'Reilly himself.
Right.
What does he say?
Yes, he has a claim against Bill O'Reilly himself, saying that he wished to influence, you know, get his voice heard on Bill O'Reilly's airwaves in response to the unrest in Ferguson, trying to give the a more hopeful and more conciliatory message about race relations in the country. And according to the complaint, it says O'Reilly responded that it would put African-Americans in too positive a light. Now, that's just an allegation, and it's interesting because Kelly Wright's part of it. He's the only one, I believe, at this point who is speaking from the editorial side, at least with respect to this. Most of the other people are on the financial side of things. That said, I mean, there aren't that many potential complainants on the editorial side. So it is a remarkable document, though. Mm-hmm. This is about 60 pages of a laundry list of things that this woman allegedly did. And it's tempting to say, oh, this is an isolated problem, it's just one woman. But the allegations don't allow that interpretation. If you believe the allegations, then this is a systemic thing where Fox News knew about this problem years ago and did nothing to respond to it, nothing to correct it, because the complaint says that this concern was raised with Fox News executives as early as, I believe, 2008, and certainly after that as well. Mm. And Fox News didn't part ways with Judith Slater until earlier this year.
And then you see what happened with Bill O'Reilly with these allegations, these claims being paid off or paid out, these women being paid
right.
not to Settlement. Talk. Settlements, yes, that's the word. So, and sign NDAs and keep. And Bill O'Reilly kept his job until the New York Times published that story.
Yeah, I mean, the debate within Fox News appeared to be, do we fire someone after four sexual harassment settlements? Maybe we should wait for a fifth. There were four sexual harassment settlements and one settlement for just straight up kind of like abuse, mistreatment that O'Reilly had over his career. And that didn't appear to be enough to dislodge him. Then someone else came forth and we had this boycott, this ad boycott that was helped to, it was pushed by Media Matters and other progressive interests. And finally, I think Fox News figured out that it wasn't going to be able to bury this particular dispute. So they commenced separation discussions with O'Reilly. But really, they sought to hold on to Bill O'Reilly. There is nothing good to say about management with respect to that. They got rid of O'Reilly only because they had to. It was not a matter of principle. It was not a decision that was made in favor of a tolerant or a workplace with integrity. It was made only because they were forced to. And this is precisely the conduct that 21st Century Fox and the company that's, of course, run by the Murdoch family, is controlled by the Murdoch family, exhibited back in 2011, 2010, with respect to the phone hacking scandal in the UK.
Yeah, and so do you think this will...
They never did the right thing.
Right. Do you think this will doom their effort to buy Sky TV?
I question that. Now, they have a 39% controlling interest in Sky TV right now, and that's obviously the jewel that they've been going for. And the phone hacking scandal sunk their attempt back then to acquire Sky TV. Now they're going after it again, and it just so happens that another scandal is falling on them. Too bad they didn't try, you know, a year or two ago. Maybe that would have been the perfect timing. But I would be surprised. There's a lot of money behind that attempt, behind this bid. And they've put a lot of effort into getting full 100% ownership of Sky TV. I don't know. But I do think that there are a lot of people in the UK who are trying to push against it. And there are a lot of interest groups here that are trying to go, that have made sure that the British regulators are fully aware of all the complaints against Fox News here.
All right, Eric, we'll have to leave it there. Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post. Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, filmmaker and screenwriter John Ridley's documentary Let It Fall follows the 10 years leading up to and including the LA riots.
Even in the most heated moments, you know, people are making these decisions, making these choices, and it just, you know, we call it Let It Fall for a reason. You know, there was almost this philosophy, at least over that 10-year period, where people just had an intellectual shrug to the problem.
John Ridley on the upcoming 25th anniversary of the LA riots. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. This weekend marks the 25th anniversary of the 1992 LA riots, a wrenching experience for everyone who lived through it. More than 50 people were killed, 2,000 injured, and $1 billion in damages, and a major political and cultural inflection point for the city of LA. Only 2 years earlier, screenwriter and director John Ridley had moved to Los Angeles to write for TV shows like Martin and The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He's had many film and TV credits since. He's won an Academy Award for screenwriting on the film 12 Years a Slave. Now he's made a documentary about the riots. It's called Let It Fall, and he joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Very good to see you again. How are you?
Great to have you. All right, so you moved here 2 years before the riots.
Yeah.
What was your experience of them?
My experience, I'd moved, I'm actually originally from a very small town in Wisconsin, and so my experience with police officers' interactions was very different. But I'd moved to New York City in the mid to late 80s, and that was, you know, Bernie Goetz and Howard's Beach. And there was a different sense of my blackness, obviously very particular to me, not the same thing other people here in LA were experiencing. But when I left New York, I really thought I was going to the Los Angeles that I remembered from 84 and the Olympics and had seen at the Academy Awards, in a place where, okay, if New York could not be cosmopolitan, LA would be in a different way. And people warned me. They said, you know, be mindful of police officers. You're going to have a different reaction. And having had two very different experiences, I thought, well, how different could it be? And shortly after arriving, there was the Rodney King beating and the assault. So my experience coming out here was one of already, again, being aware of how bad things could be to a degree, but not understanding that there was a real cultural systemic issue that had gotten to a very bad place, but still had yet room to travel.
Yeah. And so you didn't at the time know about all the antecedents, everything that led up to
I was
the
aware of it in a way
riots.
That, you know, I was aware of what had happened in Westwood with the Karen Tashima shooting. I was aware of Operation Hammer, but I was aware of things in a warning. It was almost as though you were hearing things during the Great War that were coming across a divide of an ocean, mm-hmm. that, wow, that is really something bad that's happening out there. But, you know, South Central is so far away from Westwood, so removed that, you know, clearly there are these other spaces in Los Angeles that you can just navigate and it's okay.
Let's talk about some of the incidents that led up to the beating, to the riots, and the explosion, and that you document in your film. So you start your film 10 years previously.
We started in 1982, and obviously people can make a case for when the beginning of all this was, all this being the uprising itself. But there was in 1982, leading up to 1982 in particular, the police used a method of subduing suspects known as the chokehold. And it was applied or over-applied to people of color. And particularly people of color were dying of this application. And even how it was contextualized, because Chief Gates at that time said part of the problem was that people of color, black people specifically, do not respond the way that, quote unquote, normal people do. People took it in different ways, but certainly saying that black people are not normal.
I think the exact quote is, "Blacks' arteries don't open up as fast as in normal people."
As in normal people. My father was a doctor. That does not sound like any kind of learned medical statements. At any rate, because of these deaths, the chokehold was barred. So the police had to figure out a way to subdue suspects that they thought, and this was the beginning of the PCP, the crack cocaine era. There was a belief within the police force that when you were on PCPs, you were superhuman, and black people were more likely to be caught up in arrests that involved drugs. So how do you subdue individuals? If you couldn't use the chokehold, they introduced what was called the PR-24, which was the metal baton, which later in 1991 was obviously used in excessive force against Rodney King. So we just looked at that space of time, that 10 years from the end of what could be called the chokehold era, up through the Foothill incident, which was the beating of Rodney King, and then through the uprising itself.
And what I really liked about your documentary was it didn't take a point of view per se, that it gave everyone their due, people on all sides, and you really understand what they were thinking at the time. So one incident can be told from two diametrically opposed positions, and yet you understand both sides of the position. One of them is this detective. His name is Robert Simpak. He puts this whole thing in context, right? I mean, he was at the
one of the last chokehold deaths. James Mincy, who died from chokehold, he was also at the arrest of Rodney King. So he was an officer who was at, for our story, bookended it between these two very terrible arrests. But yes, he was someone who tried to contextualize this from the point of view of an LAPD officer.
Right, because you and everybody from the president, George Bush, H.W. Bush, on down to just a regular person who's watching this on TV sees this video and is like, this is outrageous.
Right.
And there's no excuse for this. But then you put it in a context with this interview.
Well, we hope to put it in some perspectives.
Right.
And this officer, Simpak, saying, oh, well, you think that was bad, but it was all police procedure.
Right.
And I can think of arrests that were far worse. And says, off the tip of my tongue, I believe he says, I can think of 10 arrests that were much worse, much more violent. Other people saying within the community, the black community, yes, it was horrible, but we saw that all the time. Another police officer, a commander from one of the divisions in the South Central area, saying, In the 25 years prior, we've seen some very terrible incidents. But when have you seen a beating among police officers or between police officers and an arrestee to that degree? So just have that range of reaction to this from different communities and across the board throughout this telling of the story was very, very important to us. And I was going to say, you know, among black community, Korean-American community, Asian American, not just Korean Americans, Japanese American, Hispanics, police, citizenry, administrators. And look, you pick a subject matter like this, you choose those who you are going to interview. You can't pretend that there's not some opinion or selection that's going on. But for all of us, we really tried to remove our opinion and our perspective as these stories were unfolding and saying that we're building an apparatus to deliver other people's points of view and try to deliver them in a very dispassionate manner.
But you can't understand the beating of Rodney King without understanding, as you say, the move to get rid of the chokehold and the use of these batons, the crack epidemic, the PCP epidemic, all of that.
I don't think that you can, because I certainly think you can look at the videotape and just say, that's a beating and that's outrageous.
Right, which it is.
Which it, certainly in my opinion, it absolutely is. But I think to at least try to understand what those officers potentially were thinking in that moment, to understand the reaction of communities that have been visited with this kind of force constantly, to understand how that kind of force ended up in the police department, that it wasn't just necessarily cops picking up batons and just saying, we're going to beat people, that there was at least an evolution to it. Again, not saying it was right or wrong, but it came from somewhere, it arrived to a place, and there was a cascade effect across these communities. I think that is the point of the story.
I think also what's interesting is you have these characters in your movie, and you don't really understand at first who they are until way later.
Yeah.
So these are guys from South Central, and they've got a very distinct point of view on what happened.
Yeah.
And then we don't find out until later the role that they played. And why did you, in the beating of Reginald Denny,
right.
So why did you want to do that, wait until far into the movie for us as viewers to understand who they
yeah.
are?
For me as a storyteller and for a lot of individuals, we adopted that that form of telling the narrative. We start the film with what seems like just a random group of individuals who are just talking about recollections of the uprising at first, and then they're talking about how they came to California, their own family experiences. And with those four individuals in particular, without giving too much away, I think it would have been very easy to state who they are up front. And for certain central figures, and we did try to talk to the four indicted officers who chose not to speak with us, but would have adopted the same technique to not over-explain who they are, to try to get a sense of them as an individual, and then reveal their involvement in events and have people have to reconcile what they think they know, what they thought they knew, and with what is presented in front of them.
Yeah, because you are saying these are humans. These are humans with lots of different motivations and thoughts and emotions and complicated points of view.
And made incredibly human mistakes. There were some individuals who were merely caught up in the sweep of these moments. But there are other individuals who made choices. Some of them were just, in my opinion, absolutely wrong choices. Some people tried to make the right decision and went horribly wrong. Other people made choices that I don't know I would have the capacity to make.
I mean, I think it's interesting, the idea of making choices in a, you know, non-fraught environment, in a rational space, versus making a choice in the heat of battle, if you will, in the middle of chaos.
Yeah, and the thing I think people have to remember is that the it wasn't beating uprising. It wasn't verdict uprising. There were stages in between. And even on that day when the verdict came back, there was another incident. I don't think anybody could have prevented all things from happening. But there was yet one more opportunity to quell an issue that could have potentially contained things, could have limited things, could have gone differently. So I think that's very important to say, look, even in the most heated moments, you know, people are making these decisions, making these choices, and it just, you know, we call it let it fall for a reason. You know, there was almost this philosophy, at least over that 10-year period, where people just had an intellectual shrug to the problem, in my opinion. It was just, well, you know, what are you going to do?
Mm. I want to play a clip of tape from Lieutenant Michael Mullen. He's retired, and he was actually the commander on site.
Yeah.
And he made the decision to pull back and not help people who were in dire straits. I mean,
being beaten to death, essentially.
Reginald Denny was being beaten to death, and he decides to do nothing.
Did I see on the television Reginald Denny being beat? Yes, I did. And it's ugly. And in war, ugly things happen, but you have to make the hard decisions. And the hard decision I made, we cannot get him help. We can't. So you know what? Turn the television off. It's ugly. It's horrible. It breaks my heart, but there's nothing we can do.
And that was because he was afraid that his officers would be attacked.
He was worried that if an officer went out and was trying to help someone and that officer was attacked themselves, then you got to send another officer in to try to retrieve that individual. And it's just going to get to the point where you cannot risk lives or start to diminish manpower. And at that point, he talks about turning the TV off. The police were literally, they were at the RTD bus station, which was in a marshaling point. and we're watching these things happening on television. I should say, following that, though, you had citizens who went out to that intersection.
Black citizens.
Black citizens in the middle of this who went out and saved a white man's life. They also saved Asian Americans were being beaten on the street that day. Hispanics. A lot of people ended up dying. The majority of people who died were black. But at that moment, as someone says in the documentary, anybody who wasn't black was getting their ass kicked. So you had some citizenry, black individuals, who waded out into that circumstance and said, it doesn't matter what race these individuals are, you know, enough is enough. You did also have police officers who disobeyed that direct order and went out and found individuals who were being assaulted, retrieved them, and brought them back.
Does he regret that decision, Moulin?
No, he does not. And he's very resolute in the concept that he could not risk his officers' lives, or that if his officers went into the field, they were going to have to use deadly force to protect themselves or to protect other individuals. And at that point, it goes, in his words, beyond being just a riot of burning and looting to slaughter, and was very concerned about that and is absolutely resolute in that. But across the board, you know, we have so many individuals who made choices that may not have been the choice that I made. And again, not just to the negative, but doing things that were absolutely heroic, that I look at that and I hope that I would not make decisions that were necessarily wholly negative. I don't know that I could have made these decisions that were so heroic. But we also had people who were just trying to do the right thing, just trying to maintain themselves, maintain their communities, and things went wrong. One of the most unexpected individuals to me in this story says at the end of this film, those who are in uniform are human beings, those who walk the streets of South Central are human beings, and no one is greater in the eyes of the Most High. I think that was the most appropriate line on which we could end this story.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me. Deeply appreciate it.
That's John Ridley. His documentary about the 92 LA riots is called Let It Fall. It airs this Friday on ABC at 9 p.m. Coming up, we remember filmmaker Jonathan Demme. He made Silence of the Lambs and a lot of concert films like Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Academy Award-winning director Jonathan Demme died today in New York. He was 73 years old. Demme was maybe best known for directing this 1991 thriller.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Ugh. Anthony Hopkins opposite Jodie Foster in The Silence of the Lambs. The film won all top five categories at the Oscars, Best Actress, Actor, Adapted Screenplay, Best Picture, and Director for Demme. And though that drama was about a serial cannibalist and a young FBI agent who needs his help, it was Demme's most acclaimed film. He had a prolific career making documentaries and concert films like this. Talking Heads performing Girlfriend is Better live on their concert film Stop Making Sense. Tim Grierson is here to pay tribute to Jonathan Demme. He is senior U.S. critic for Screen International and a film critic for The New Republic. Hi there, Tim. How are you?
I'm good, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Well, aside from The Silence of the Lambs, Stop Making Sense was one of Demme's most important works. Talk about how groundbreaking that was. It came out in 1984.
Yeah, Jonathan Demme worked with Talking Heads to sort of conceive a different sort of concert film, and a couple things that they sort of came up with that were innovative for concert documentaries was, number one, not showing the crowd, that they felt like if you actually put the home viewer, the people in the theater, actually on the stage, it would be a much more intimate experience as opposed to cutting away to the crowd, which is such a staple in concert documentaries. And also just an idea of not doing a bunch of quick cuts, especially now in sort of the MTV era. We're so used to concert films being cut. But Jonathan Demme figured out if you actually just sit on a performer and let them do their thing, there's something really magical about watching people in the middle of a performance. And certainly in Stop Making Sense, one of the great aspects of that film is just watching David Byrne, the lead singer of Talking Heads, do his thing in those different songs. It's magical watching him perform.
Yeah, and you really do. When you're watching it, you really feel like you're part of it, and there is something there. He does try to erase that boundary. I do feel that watching that movie. He also did a recent documentary, similar, a concert documentary based on Justin Timberlake.
Tennessee kids, y'all ready? Tennessee kids, y'all ready? Hey. Vegas, y'all ready? Let me see you clap.
Okay, so similar technique with that film?
In some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. Last year on Netflix, he made Justin Timberlake and the Tennessee Kids, and it was part of Justin Timberlake's 2020 Experience Tour, and it was the final shows of that two-year tour in Las Vegas. So this is a huge pop spectacle, but even though it's not the same type of music, even though it's not the same type of crowd, the intimacy that Jonathan Demme actually brought to the Justin Timberlake film is really exceptional. In the same way, you do feel like not just that you're part of the crowd, but you're really sort of interacting with Timberlake and his backup band and his dancers and his backup singers. It creates probably the most kind of intimate, big arena concert film that's ever been made. And Timberlake was a huge fan of Stop Making Sense. And when they first met about something else, Timberlake said, you know, I'd be kind of interested in making a concert film with you because I love Stop Making Sense so much. And, you know, they both kind of like hit upon this idea of how to do it. And it never like really played on the big screen, which is a shame. And I hope Netflix will change their mind and put it on the big screen because you need to see this film on as big a screen as possible. But that being said, I've watched it several times at home, and a dance party kicks off just about every time this film comes on. It's pretty tremendous.
So in the 80s, he made a bunch of quirky films, Something Wild, Married to the Mob, and then, of course, Silence of the Lambs. And then after that, he used his clout to direct a film that at the time probably was difficult to get made. This was the film Philadelphia. It helped draw attention to the AIDS crisis. Let's hear a clip.
I love the law. I know the law. I excel at practicing.
What do you love about the law, Andrew?
many things. What I love the most about the law?
Yes.
Is that every now and again, not often, but occasionally, you get to be a part of justice being done.
Okay, that's Tom Hanks there playing a man with HIV who was fired by his law firm because of his disease. Denzel Washington, his lawyer. And so this was in 1993. How daring was that movie?
Well, I think especially looking back, what's remarkable about Philadelphia is that in a lot of ways it's a very traditional or seemingly conventional sort of legal drama, court case kind of drama, as Tom Hanks is sort of fighting against this law firm that fired him. But actually what's remarkable about the movie is that what Demme did was use a sort of traditional kind of narrative to really create a sense of empathy for a character and a community that really had never been seen that much in a mainstream Hollywood movie. Especially, I think, what's incredible about Philadelphia is just Demme's use of these close-ups of Tom Hanks as his character Andy is getting worse and worse. Now we don't even think about this, but at the time, what was really amazing was that what Jonathan Demme was essentially doing was to say, look at these people. Look at them. These are people we don't see in mainstream movies at all. We barely see them in even independent films. But these are people who are part of our world, and we should not be afraid of them. We should not be scared of their disease. We need to look at them as other people, just like ourselves. Now that seems like such an obvious thought, but at the time, it seemed kind of incredible to do that. And, you know, Tom Hanks' performance is wonderful, but what Jonathan Demme always does so well in his movies is he just serves the story. And in that movie, he's serving the story of bringing to light the condition that people were not talking about.
Well, Tim, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Always my pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
That's Tim Gerson. He's senior U.S. critic for Screen International. He's also a film critic for The New Republic. And we've been remembering Jonathan Demme. He died today of complications from esophageal cancer. He was 73 years old. And Christian Bordell joins us now with the listener feedback.
Hey there, Madeline Hi. Brand. I loved Stop Making Sense. I remember when that movie came out.
I enjoyed
it so much. And all those early Talking Heads albums as well.
Yeah.
But we talked earlier about the Sanctuary Cities issue. Mm-hmm. And so we asked our listeners whether they think L.A. should be a sanctuary city, if California itself should even designate itself as a sanctuary state. Heidi Shaw wrote in, yes, 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 we should be a sanctuary city and state. And Lucian Fick agreed. He said yes. Anne Brockman, however, did not agree. She said no. What's missing, though, from these people's notes are just why they feel this way. So we'd love to hear from more of our listeners on this issue, which is an important one right now, and we'd love to hear why you feel the way you do about it.
Right.
So let us know.
Sanctuary, yay or nay?
Yeah.
And why, most importantly.
Exactly.
Yay, nay, why. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.